Well, we've had quite a number of things happen here since 2 weeks ago. Two earthquakes and all kinds of minor things, and a heat wave. But we're not doing as badly as the Babylonians did at the time of the writing of the book of Daniel. One thing about the Old Testament books that I think most people have not considered: the books are attributed to deity, but no proof of the actual presence of deity has ever been formally delivered. We talk about God's will, and that's very commonly referred to in the scriptures, but just under what circumstance this will expressed itself is usually very dim. I think the answer is that these old books are, for the most part, a record and an interpretation of experiences. Most of the Old Testament books and the scriptures of other peoples are the records of repeating experiences. If in the course of history, in 50 situations, the conclusion is always determined by the integrity of the circumstance, then it is attributed to deity. In other words, there is proof of cause and effect. There is proof of moral value and factor in the happenings of mankind. These evidences have been gradually compiled. For instance, the story that we have of Jonah and the whale occurs in several different systems. In fact, in the Job, of course, the Jonah, it is referred to as a great fish. Jesus is the first one to call it a whale. But the whale story occurs in Babylon, it occurs in the Far East, it occurs all over, always in the remote past. These stories seem to be, therefore, a series of fables like Aesop's fables, each one with a distinct moral meaning, a meaning that has continued and been re-emphasized over periods of thousands of years. It is not that a single incidence is determined. It is that the testimony of the ages supports certain results as the results of certain causes. And as these results of good causes are nearly always benevolent, and the bad causes nearly always end in tragedy, this is attributed finally as solid evidence of the existence of God. If these different incidents were haphazard, no pattern, no value obvious, it might not have followed this pattern, or not led to a religious conclusion. But where certain things always result in the same conclusions, it seems reasonable to assume that those conclusions are the will of something stronger than the human being. Nature more powerful than man, God more powerful than nature. But always in behind all of these incidents, an integrity, a value for value pattern. And the ancients lived building on this concept for hundreds and thousands of years, put together these fables to express the evidence of the presence of a divine power judging all things. Now, the materialist might say that this is not demonstrable, that it's not true, that it's all haphazard, that it's all fancy. But then we look back on Caesar, dead at the foot of Pompey's statue, Alexander, dead at the foot of the walls of Babylon, Napoleon in St. Helena, Hitler in the bunker in Berlin, Mussolini hanging on a lamppost in Italy. These things all seem to add up to the fact that these men did not live according to an integrity that it was acceptable to nature. Now, if some of one or two of them had been gloriously successful, we might question it. But where the same causes and the same circumstances invariably result in the same consequences, we begin to suspect that there is a law involved. And in the Old Testament, this law, dressed in fable, gives us the wonderful stories of the Old Testament. They are all cosmic legends, or legends that have been handed down for thousands of years, in new dresses, new applications, new interpretations, but always the same essential integrities and moralities. It comes out of this that most ancient people decided that the Lord, God, or whoever we may be, liked to have us behave ourselves. When we do not behave ourselves, we become like small children requiring chastisement of some kind. And always we get it. Now, we have the same problem here today in the world. We have the world that has prided itself upon its accomplishments, that has apparently risen above all natural laws, that is now sinking into a morass of corrupted natural laws. We have done it all wrong, and we're not going to win this way. And when we go down to the defeat that is inevitable, 5,000 years from now, we will be evidences of the righteous judgment of deity. No one has seen deity, no one is likely to see him, but his works are obvious. And there is no other explanation that man can never defy the laws of nature without suffering. Now, natural laws are a little different from divine laws in this factor. The natural laws are concerned primarily with forms, with bodies, with the circumstances of environment and things of this nature. Plants and flowers and animals and creatures of all kinds live according to their own natures. They have no individuality such as we have. They live together, they die together. The whole groups of them perish together in great cosmic disasters. But for the individual, a certain higher law takes over. There is not only the physical laws of nature, but the moral laws of ethics. And these are very, very important. The Ten Commandments are a good example of this, presumably given to Moses on Mount Sinai by the very hand of God. Actually, those Ten Commandments are as old as time. The most primitive people believed them and held them to be true, because wherever they were violated, trouble resulted. Trouble that could not be explained away. The only way it could be explained was disobedience. But disobedience to what? Disobedience to some kind of an ethical code that is very difficult to capture in words, but which reaffirms and reasserts itself wherever conduct of any kind exists. So out of the mixtures of these fables and legends, there comes a sort of intellectual picture of what the divine will might be like and what type of a God there is. Now, if we wish to say that there is no God, then we must attribute all this to the operations of nature. But nature, on the other hand, is not adequate to explain many of these things. Man's conduct is often in violation of nature. Sometimes it is punished while keeping the law of nature, apparently, because it is a different code for the human being. But the fact remains that wherever we find a code set up in ancient times, like the Justinian Code or the Code of Hammurabi, we always find the same essential rules, with the statement that they were divinely bestowed upon mankind. This divine bestowal was apparently a series of repetitions of effects for similar causes. That no matter how many times we made the same mistake, we had the same punishment for it. There's no matter how we got along doing well. Time after time, we maybe sacrifice a great deal, but we try very hard. And somewhere in the pattern, there seems to be a reward for that. We are rewarded for what we do right, and we are given a sharp blow on the rear end when we do wrong. And out of this comes integrity, the final footing of things upon the basis of the realities of life. Now, in the case of these certain fables that we can think of, that are repetitious. Take, for example, the legend of Samson. This legend is found in at least 5 different religions and over a period of thousands of years. The stories are almost always identical. A version of all of the Samson stories are found in various evidences, such as Hercules and other great heroes who made the same mistakes, did the same things, received the same punishments, and were finally raised to some kind of higher recognition. The Odyssey of Homer appears again and again in the literature of the world. But it is not the incident that is important, or the story. It is the unfoldment of a pattern of laws, that things are according to the realities of a life bigger than ours. We live in a universe which we talk about conquering, but which inevitably conquers us. We break rules of nature, and we suffer accordingly. We break rules of ethics, and we destroy ourselves. We destroy ourselves through extreme competition. We destroy ourselves through ulterior motives, from lack of self-control, lack of self-discipline, lack of integrity, lack of faith, lack of love, lack of hope. These things, when they are permitted to endure, get us into trouble, and it becomes evidence that nature and nature's God wants us to keep these rules and do these things according to the highest moral ethics that we know. Morality and ethics then more or less arise from experience. They arise from doing the same thing. The burglar robs many houses and is not caught, but finally he is. The individual who commits a crime of importance may escape the judgment of jury, but in some way the tragedy comes back to him. We are paid for what we do in the coin of recompense. If we do well, we get a good record. If we do badly, we get a poor record. One of the most important examples of this was the case of Croesus, who in ancient times was the richest man who ever lived. Of course, he'd be more or less in the middle class only today, but in those times, he was the top man in all matters of money. He led a philosopher once into his great treasuries, which were overwhelming and overflowing with gold and jewels and precious things. And this tremendous amassment was the greatest in all the world. And he showed it proudly, all the wealth, all the power, all the things he had treasured and gathered, all the successes that were piled into that great treasury. And the philosopher looked at it for a moment, and then he turned to Croesus and he said, "Yes, and a man with better iron will take it all away from you." And this is happening right now. We have all these various attitudes of success, but weaponry can take away almost anything that the individual can accumulate, himself included. So all the way back in those times, it became obvious to people that when you do things consistently wrong, where you do not keep the rules of life, life punishes. Not because it is despotic, but because, like a good parent, it is determined to prove that only right can survive. And until right survives, everything that evades it or avoids it fades away and is not seen again. And so we come now to the little story about the Feast of Belshazzar, who was king of all Chaldea. And in this day's story, a prophet by the name of Daniel, as found in the book of Daniel, reads the handwriting on the wall of the banquet hall of Belshazzar. All the various wise people of Chaldea tried to write, to read or interpret these letters, which appeared as though in blood upon the wall of the great banquet hall, where Belshazzar and his cohorts were celebrating a victory over their enemies. And finally, no one being able to interpret it, they sent for Daniel. And Daniel looked at the inscription on the wall and gave it, according to various editions of the scriptures, about a dozen variant interpretations. But the main one that has come down to us as the most important, is the one which says, "You are found lacking. You are weighed in the balance, and the balance doesn't balance." So that in reality and substance, you weighed in the balance and found wanting. Now, I used that title, but I kind of tucked a couple of words on the end of it that I'm afraid cannot be attributed to pure Belshazzar. It is, I added after it, you were weighed in the balance and found wanting too much. Every one of us today is suffering from the fact that if we are weighed in the balance, there are certain factors that would require immediate correction. We would be forced to change a number of our ways and our thoughts, and we would find that we can support this by a careful study of the scriptures of every important religion of the world. And 1,000 years from now, our experience will be part of a scripture written at a later date. We are going to have exactly the same interpretation, and we are going to have our problem attributed to deity. We are going to be weighed in the balance, and we are going to be found unbalanced, untrue, unfair, unfaithful. And for that, we will be punished. Now, the ancients looking at this situation and comparing it to 50 others that had gone before over a period of 5,000 years, all coming out exactly the same, would assume that it is not well for the individual to practice those faults by which such conditions are produced. If we are to be weighed in the balance and found wanting, then we must definitely realize that we are talking about some form of integrities or values. We know that because, like Belshazzar, we're in the midst of a war. We are being conquered and conquering. We are trying desperately to maintain a system of beauty and truth by means of violence. This is against practically every religion and shows up time and time again in the fables that are written about the conduct of mankind. We are therefore constantly in the presence of evidence. And when someone says, what proof is there that you can't do as you please? The proof is there. The proof is in the fact that individuals who do as they please have two choices. If they choose to do what is right, they are successful. And if they choose to do what is wrong, failure is as inevitable as it was 2,000 years ago. The time factor does not overcome the qualities of ethics. There only can be one surviving world pattern, and that is a pattern in which integrity is the foundation upon which all else is built. The only nation that is going to survive is a nation that is honest. The only leader that will ultimately lead anywhere and accomplish any good is the leader who is honest. And the only citizen who will have a safe domicile in the world here or to come will be the citizen who is honest. All these subterfuges, all this crime, all this evasion is simply a kind of madness. And nearly all powerful rulers have suffered from this type of insanity, the type of believing in the infallibility of their own will over the inevitables of life. Each individual who comes to a certain point of egotism decides that he is greater than the laws that govern man. He tries to break these laws, and as sure as circumstance, the laws break him. So we have now a problem that is coming into focus, that we are all being weighed in the balance again. And we are beginning to realize, as not for a long time have we been thinking, that we are really being tested for something. We are being checked to find out what we really believe. We are going to be divided, the wheat from the chaff. We are going to be found guilty of wrong or blessed for the rewards of right. And these decisions have to come. And there is no way of avoiding them. So we look at what there is. Now, also we know from the story of the Old Testament and many other books, man was not merely a plaything of the Lord. Man was made to reflect and reveal the glory of reality. The actual work of man was to prepare him for universal citizenship. to prepare him for an eternal existence in a beautiful and eternal world. Up to this time, this has not happened. But it's also true that up to this time, there is no world ever come that was that deserved it. Many things start beautifully and nobly, but of course, along the way, temptation comes in. Opportunity for profit comes in. The desire for personal recognition comes in. All these things, little by little, the ethics disappears. It disappears with corruption, and there can be no corruption in nature that is not subject to punishment. And the stories of the cities of the plains and Solomon and Gomorrah are not fables. They have occurred many, many, many times, some within the lifetime of the present generation. Always, however, back of it is the immutable fact that good must prevail, and that which is not good must disappear. And it cannot be thrown away, and it cannot be taken away by prayer. If we believe that we can be reformed by asking for reformation, we find that it hasn't happened. The only time that we can be reformed is then we, of our own will and intention, correct the faults that we suffer from and present ourselves in our best light to the law which judges all things. This problem, then, we are facing in the present international situation. We have discovered more than man ever knew before and abused it more completely. We have advanced further in science than ever before and have fallen back deeper in ethics than any civilization of importance. Others have fallen as the result of doing the thing we are doing, but we somehow hope vainly that we will succeed where truth tells us we have to fail. Now, having come to some kind of a reasonable realization of this, we can pass from the great picture, which we all see every day on television, read it in the newspaper, see it set forth in the journal, and hear it shouted from the pulpits of 10,000 churches, that we have got to do something to change the basic pattern of society. Now, we find that society functions well only when the leader is just and the follower is honest. Until this combination exists, there is no permanence in anything. There is no way of preventing a people from becoming disobedient if leadership is disloyal or unworthy of leadership. It is therefore necessary for us to start somewhere to find out what we have to do. And we can get a great deal of information on this subject from the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount. These two documents we regard as theological. We may like to think that they're just something that somebody said but didn't really mean. Or it was something that somebody said but nobody can live up to it. This is not true. There's nothing in the Ten Commandments or the Sermon on the Mount that is impossible. But there is much in both of them that is impossible if the individual himself wishes to remain impossible. If we prefer to take a chance and use the cocaine and die from an overdose 2 or 3 years later, we have the right to do this. No one can stop us, but the punishment comes directly upon ourselves. Everyone who abuses any fact of life will suffer from the abuse which he has committed. There is no escaping this, no way of escaping it. And so, because of its inevitability and immutability, it has been attributed to deity. It is attributed to the only power or force or energy that we can recognize, which when it operates, gives righteous judgment, bestows upon that which it works with the blessing of integrity, and punishes that which departs from the laws of life. These realizations come back to all of us. Now, in this particular generation, there are a great many people who are beginning to wake up to these things. In the last 5 or 10 years, the interest in trying to find an answer, this interest has increased 1,000-fold. Hundreds of organizations have been created in an effort to try to find an answer that will stand up against the pressures of the time. Well, some of these organizations have done very well for people, and some others have done very well for themselves. This problem is one we all have to face. Wherever an improvement is demonstrated or dynamically disseminated in the hope of personal profit, there's something wrong in the picture. The idea that we are going to find the illusions, the truths behind them for $100 an evening is much, much wrong. No can do. Not possible. The first point about a true ethics is to get out of the idea that the reformation of mankind is the greatest financial opportunity in the history of the world. That never was there such a chance to get rich out of trying to make people behave themselves. Unfortunately, however, the emphasis is wrong to begin with, and the people do not behave themselves because the inspiration of integrity is missing. And therefore, in this time, it is very important for us to realize that we are combining not for profit, but for salvation. That we are coming together not because we can buy and sell cheaper from each other. Or now we are not going to build a new civilization to get over tariff laws. These kind of things we are not going to think of anymore. We are going to discover that we must unite for common good or perish. That we have been given every opportunity imaginable to improve our dispositions, and we for the most part stay the same. On the other hand, the Lord works in mysterious ways, truly. Because go back to the scripture again, and we have the history of the good people. We have those who kept the law, sometimes under great stress and privation and even death. Martyrdom in some instances was their only visible reward. But these good people are blessed in the life of the world in which we live. And because of this fact that this material world is not the whole story, those who have lived well, even if it has cost them their lives, are richer than those who have had everything in this world that they wanted and die impoverished in ethics. So we have to make some decisions in this particular problem. The decisions of how to handle the responsibilities of the moment. Reforms are necessary in every area, but wherever there is a reform, it interferes with somebody's profit. And it's the profit that's worrying us. The other type of profit is hard to find. We are actually working constantly under the shadow of ulterior motive. We feel that this tremendous sorrow and pain and worry of the world is a tremendous opportunity to forward other ulterior motives and become very wealthy over the sufferings, uncertainties, and fears of our neighbors. This is only going to make it worse. This is going to bring again another example of what happens to those who do not keep the rules. The old scriptures tell us that they were cast out, that they wandered in the desert, and had to go through great trials and tribulations before they were permitted to ask forgiveness and return to the rules of the game. This is the proper attitude we have now. What do we need primarily at the moment? We need what we have needed probably off and on for the last 6, 7, 8,000 years. Something that we've had small examples of or short periods in which integrities were fashionable. But these were not very common and didn't last very long. What we have got to do now is to begin to build in the values that we know to be right and build them into an idealistic system. A materialist is essentially an atheist. A materialist does not believe in a divine power, or he wouldn't act the way he does. Now, the fact that he does what he does, he feels he is a free agent, that he can do anything he pleases to do. And for a certain time and under certain conditions, he's correct. If he wants to waste a life, he can do it. If he wants to drink himself to death, he can do it. If he wants to go under narcotics, he can do it. and he will shorten his life or fill his life with sorrows and miseries and sickness and a premature death as a reward for his disobedience of common sense and nominal reasonable patterns. But there is a way in which we can gradually get over this primary materialism by really reading the scriptures again, from which we learn that the earth and the fullness thereof belong to the Lord. This is something we've completely forgotten. As at the present time, the earth belongs to whoever can get a mortgage on it. And everyone, Napoleon, Caesar, Hitler, Mussolini, all these have tried to get that mortgage. The earth is here and they are gone. Actually, we do not own this planet. We do not own anything, because all we have is a right of occupancy. And just as sure as we have this right of occupancy, we can get loan it to somebody else, we can bestow it, but whatever we bestow again is only the right of occupancy. We have a world built upon great extravagances of land, of power, of wealth, of profit, all of these things contributing to the troubles we have. We cannot have a world that is devoted to immorality and at the same time have a beautiful moral universe. And we have to start where we can. We know that most of the important corrections would result in somebody else getting mad at us. We would be interfering with a glorious system of profit upon which our whole world way is built. We would take away from the great and powerful organizations their ability to control the financial resources of the planet. So to prevent this from happening, anything is preferable. Things must remain the same, or else the great pattern of economic wealth would be disturbed. Well, it has failed already. It is already failing again and more. And in a little time, it is going to be such a complete failure that nobody can believe it anymore. But they will, for a little time, string desperately and try to perpetuate a system of profit which has no foundation in facts. I would imagine now that our 6 billion fellow countrymen, or fellow world citizens, continue to multiply at the present rate, and we will find in a short time that we will use up every natural resource that we possess, that we will destroy practically every base resource of our planet. Every day more ponds and lakes and rivers are being polluted. Someday there just won't be any other. But these people work on the basis that when the time comes, we will find something to do with these things so that we can keep on being just what we are. This is unrealistic, because unless there is a terrible catastrophe which destroys the greater part of the Earth's population, which it probably is not in hand because the case is not clear enough, but we will have to face the importance of becoming moderate people. Now, I will watch the newspapers pretty closely, and these people who are working so hard to get hold of everything they have do not seem to be very happy with it. These great patterns of wealth, these fabulous incomes, these enormous investments, this process of practically buying and selling nations doesn't seem to be doing anybody any good. We only end up with the worst debt that we haven't had in history, and we also make more enemies every day than the Medes and the Persians ever knew. So we are not getting anywhere with this at all. I think we should begin now to think firmly of rewriting history. Rewriting it for the school child. Rewriting for the grammar school and a little enlarged copy for the high schools. And we also should make a nice deluxe binding on some of them for the parents to read. Because we need to know exactly what is happening in our world. We don't need to know just how many dollars we made or whether we have a deficit this year or not. We want to know exactly what is happening to a world without conscience, without integrities, and without moral foundations. We want to know what happens when we ridicule the best things there are in life, glorify that which is corrupt, and become addicted to all kinds of crimes and degeneracies. This can be result in another cataclysm, such as that which was written on the wall of Belshazzar's palace. We are being weighed now, and we will be. There's no need to go out and get tremendously upset. Its only problem is that we do need to go out and get upset to the degree that we are willing to begin to work on ourselves. Every family should have some kind of moral instruction. It should bestow this moral instruction upon its children. Every business should have a moral code by which that business is controlled and which will not be broken. Every profession should have a moral, ethical code for the practice of the members of that profession, which will not be exploited, will not be corrupted, and will not lead to the transformation of the motives of a profession. The motive of medicine is to help people who are sick. Today, the motive is cash, the tremendous amount of money involved. Money can lead and does lead and is a form of moral compromise. It is something that should never enter into human relationships. It will remain, however, as long as nobody really minds. We talk about it, but when the time comes to act, we are too busy doing something else. I think there should be a legal code set up for all the major professions, fixing completely and entirely the method and means of administering that profession. What it can do, what it can charge, and what it cannot charge, and the penalties for overcharging. This is important. Actually, the laborer is worthy of his hire. The doctor is worthy of a fee that is appropriate to the service he renders, but he is not entitled to exploit the sick. All these things are part of the loss of the moral code. Now, the sacred books of the world, all of them, were moral codes. They were codes that were intended to help people to understand what is good and what is bad. Nearly all of these books contain a factor involving the fact that those who keep these rules are blessed in the sight of the universe. They are the ones who are keeping the laws, keeping the rules, and are deserving of further consideration. Now, in China in the old days, the doctors had a cute rule. The patient hired a family physician. This family physician had his appointment on one basis only. He was to keep the family well. He received his monthly salary as long as they were well. When they got sick, his pay stopped. The entire motive now was obviously to get them well again. Whereas with us today, the longer they're sick, the more fortunate the physician becomes. But these things have to be worked through in some practical way. So we need a world ethic, something that gives us the strength and character to begin a new world charter, a new world parliament of faith and knowledge. And the seat and center of it must be religious. Now, this religion doesn't mean that the individual has to believe in any particular appearance of deity, because nobody has seen any of them. But it means that there must be an acceptance of the fact that a divine moral principle is at the root of life, demonstrated by the fact that every trouble we have comes from disobeying moral principles. Therefore, whether we believe in deity or not, if we believe in health and survival, we have to keep the rule. There is no other way. So we go into other fields where there's all kinds of dissimulations to give us problems and sickness. We also need to have a complete reconstruction of the basic code for higher education. The France now, the all education is based upon one basic idea: to take a field of specialized learning where there is probability of advancement and a very superior type of employment. We are out to get the best job there is. Well, this has been badly broken up, however, by some modern discoveries. And when these discoveries came along, there were no graduates to take the jobs. The discoveries were too recent. But they'll come, and we'll gradually have various experts. And by the time the expert gets the full training, his machine will be obsolete. This is the same way all the way along. You're not supposed to do this. Life is not supposed to be an addiction to a profession that will get riches and nothing else. There is no comfort, no beauty, no love or fineness in working machines. We may say, yes, but they do help people. Certainly they help people, but not to the degree of making them the principal objective in life. The principal objective in life when we want to help people is to care for people, to love people, to serve people, to be kind to people, and to advance those common virtues by which the people as a whole advance in their understanding of life, in the care of their children, and in the preparation of their own futures. The final purpose of this civilization is that the human being shall improve, that he shall become sufficient to be wiser and more virtuous and a better human being and a better person. He is not here simply to leave a fortune to his descendants in his will. And very often he doesn't get that far. They break it up and take it away from him while he's still alive. And this, of course, is considered to be pretty good business. It may be good business, but it is bad life. And we are all doing good business by doing wrong. And this is not good. And we can't expect everyone to change their ways, but we can take a little more suitable stand in these things. Each individual is the master of a small world of his own, which is a miniature of the great world. And this miniature world of his own he calls his family. And it is surrounded by various friends, neighbors, and so forth, and is a little constellation in itself. This little world is within the control of various members of this family. There is a perfect possibility of this family becoming a better family. This is the very secret and idea behind the teachings of Mencius, the great Chinese philosopher. The Mencius believed that the archetype of universal peace is a family living in harmony. While relatives and friends and neighbors cannot get along together, we have no right to expect nations to become better. Because nations are not problem, is it true, but they are actually aggregates of individual disorders. And as long as the individual is disordered in his own living, there will be no solution merely by spreading this disorder over the world. There is no solution in treaties, in great pacts, because before the things are even signed, we begin to find the ulterior motives that dominated their preparation. Everything has something behind it that is not right. And as long as that happens, we're going to have more examples of Belshazzar's feast. What we're looking for now is something that has right behind it, rather than right on the surface and ulterior motive underneath. And this is true in the affairs of nations, in every line of business. It is true in the quality of goods, and it is very true in entertainment. Gradually we see entertainment gradually deteriorating with only one consideration, profit. And because of the way in which the modern civilization is centered, profit centers around ignorance and stupidity. The less intelligence this art is, the greater its appeal. Nobody cares about these things. And no one has developed the judgments to judge them. There is no reason why a very short time, common sense, could not make a major change in human attitudes. Until that time comes, we've got to do it ourselves. We've got to begin to straighten out the various ideas behind ourselves. And we also have to get a clearer view of what religion does for mankind. We've got to be very careful now when we learn that many religious groups are in bad trouble economically. They've gotten themselves into something that they should never have been in. They have forgotten that the Lord God does not live in a palace. We build great churches, as Ingersoll said, cathedrals for saints, dungeons for sinners. And the dungeons are in the foundations of the cathedrals.